Would you like to stand a chance of winning a registration for our upcoming deep dive virtual retreat so you can learn from incredible agents, editors, and authors while also having the chance of winning life-changing prizes? Head to theshitaboutwriting.com and go to the deep dive page. Scroll down past all the details of the amazing lineup to find an image that you can share on your socials along with the reasons why you would like to attend. Use the hashtag deep dive or bust and tag the podcast. Each post gets you a ticket into the draw. The contest ends at midnight on the 23rd of January and the winner will be announced on the 24th. We hope it's going to be you.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the writer in your life? Are you the favorite writer in your life and you want to gift yourself something awesome? Then come take a look at the Ultimate Planner for Writers for 2025. It not only allows you to plan for your regular day-to-day with hourly time slots, it also allows you to brainstorm, research, plot, outline, do scene planning, and vision boarding all in one. And it's available as a physical planner or as an e-planner. Check out Bianca Murray and find the Planner for Writers tab for more information. Remember to order early to avoid the end of year rush. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is a Fulbright Fellow, Kundiman Fiction Fellow, and a Vona Voices Fellow whose fiction and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, Eater, The Cut, NBC News Think, Longreads, Pen America, Catapult, Gulf Coast, and Guernica, among others. She was awarded an artist fellowship from the New Jersey Council of the Arts, as well as residences at Malay Colony, where she was a Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation Creative Fellow, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Kimmel Harding Nelson Center, the Ragdale Foundation, and Willapa Bay Air. She was formerly the senior fiction editor at The Rumpist and currently serves as the editor-in-chief at Hyphen Magazine. She received an MFA in fiction from Sarah Lawrence College and splits her time between New Jersey and Taipei, Taiwan. It's my pleasure to welcome Carissa Chen. Carissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is one hell of a bio. For our listeners, we often speak about bios and query letters, and this was one that was really going to grab a lot of attention. So, Carissa, we're going to be discussing your journey to publication and inspiration for the novel, and we're going to do some deep dives into the book. For now, I just want to read the flap copy to our listeners. For those of you who are watching on YouTube, here is the cover, and we will link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. So, the book is called Home Seeking, and here is our flap copy. A single choice can define an entire life. Su Qi first sees Haiwan in their Shanghai neighborhood when she is 7 years old, drawn by the sound of his violin. Their childhood friendship blossoms into love, but when Haiwan secretly enlists in the Nationalist Army in 1947 to save his brother from the draft, Su Qi is left with just his violin and a note, "Forgive me." 60 years later, recently widowed Haiwan spots Su Qi at a grocery store in Los Angeles. It feels to Haiwan like a second chance, but Su Qi has only survived by refusing to look back. In the twilight of their lives, can they reclaim their past and the love they lost? Home Seeking follows the separated lovers through 6 decades of tumultuous Chinese history, telling Haiwan's story from the present to the past while tracing Su Qi's from her childhood to the present, meeting in the crucible of their lives. From Shanghai to Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States, neither loses sight of the home they hold in their hearts. So there we go. You've got the flap copy there. Right. So a few things I want to dive into before I dive into the actual book. One, you wrote about the inspiration of this in your author's note. I don't know if that's going to make the final copy that goes out to readers or if that was just in the arcs, but could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So the inspiration behind this book was really my grandfather, my maternal grandfather. he passed away in, I think it was 2005. And when we were going through his things afterwards, my grandmother passed away shortly after, as often happens. And so we were cleaning out, you know, their things. And we found this photograph of him and he's crying in front of a grave. And, you know, my grandfather was sort of a more like, you know, a typical kind of that generation Chinese man who didn't really show a lot of emotion. And I was really moved by this picture because he's crying in front of this grave and he's holding jaw sticks. And I asked my mom, you know, what is this about? And she said, oh, you know, he had gone to visit his mother's grave in Shanghai. And when I was younger, I kind of knew that there was something about how he had been separated from his family when he was 19 or so. And I kind of remembered when I was a young girl that he had gone back to Shanghai for the first time and that it was sort of a big deal. But it was really seeing that photograph that I realized, wow, like, you know, and I was an adult by then. I was in my 20s. So it was at that point I realized, like, what would it be like to be separated from your mother, from your, you know, parents for decades and, you know, have never seen them again? You know, to be separated at 19, I mean, I was older than he would have been at the time when he was separated from them. And to see him, like, weeping, you know, I was really trying to grapple with the amount of regret that he must have felt and, like, the longing that would never be fulfilled. So I started to want to understand the history behind that. Like, why would he have been separated? What were the historical reasons that kind of were involved in that? And, you know, the more I started to research, what became very personal became something that I understood happened to an entire generation of people, an entire, you know, it was like 2 million people who fled from China to Taiwan after the Chinese Civil War. So, you know, understanding their stories required understanding the whole background of, you know, what was happening in context. So that really became sort of my, the jumping off point for me wanting to write this book or a book that resembled this book. You know, I wasn't sure exactly what form it would take, but wanting to understand that history and writing about it. And so that was the starting point and sort of the rest of the pieces, you know, the love story and all that kind of sort of came much later. But really the basis was seeing that photograph of my grandfather crying.
Right. Yeah, it is amazing how something like that can just spark everything that follows and how something from real life can be the seed of the idea, but then you granting yourself permission to fictionalize everything else. Mm-hmm. Because I think the problem sometimes is people will find a grandparent's journal or something like that, and then they try and stay too close to their lived experience, researching mm-hmm. it, as opposed to allowing themselves to go, okay, this is the point from which I'm springing, mm-hmm. but I'm going to fictionalize it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually something that I grappled with for quite some time, because I felt like I didn't have the right to write about something that I hadn't live through. And it seemed like a very daunting task also. Like, how do I get all the details right? You know, I never lived in Shanghai in the 30s and 40s. I guess I didn't feel like, you know, I would be able to do it justice. And that felt very stressful to me. And so for a long time, you know, I really wrote about it in nonfiction. I was trying to like understand my grandfather's story and write essays about it. And I actually did publish an essay around it. But then to be able to give myself the space to fictionalize it, I think required more time and actually required a lot more research. Because once I think I had a really good grasp of the situation, of the historical events, of the time period, I felt a lot more confident and be able to sit down and be like, okay, now like let me not think about all that stuff. Let me just treat it like anything else the way I would write about, you know, the 2000s. But I don't think I was able to do that until I felt like I understood everything else and could sort of feel confident immersing myself in the world first.
That must have taken quite a bit of time then. So I'm imagining what, reading novels that were based at that time, reading memoirs, watching documentaries. What did that process look like and how long did that take?
Yeah, so I, you know, I did all of the above. I read memoirs. There are several memoirs about Shanghai at that time. I did read some, you know, novels that came out of Shanghai about that time period. You know, a lot of it was in translation. I read, you know, short stories written by soldiers who had come over from from China to Taiwan. But yeah, I did also read like a lot of academic books. You know, there's a lot of scholarship out there, and I'm very indebted to the unsung heroes of the academic scholars who did a lot of this work. And so papers and books, and, you know, I even had a scholar that I corresponded with, Odile Schroeder. She, you know, I emailed her out of the blue and I said, hey, you know, you specialize in music of Shanghai at that time period. Can you help me with these things? And asking her a lot of questions, basically anything that I could find, you know, Wikipedia entries, like video footage that was uploaded on YouTube. And, you know, I did try to do some interviews when I was in Taiwan on my Fulbright, both, you know, I tried to find people to interview who were of that era, but when I got there, people were like, you know, a lot of them have passed away and a lot of them are also a lot older. So I ended up interviewing, you know, their children or like grandchildren, people who had known their stories, which was also like very interesting to get that perspective as well. So all in all, you know, this book took me over, you know, if you count the amount of time I spent researching, it took me over a decade to write. I mean, pen to paper, I think it took about, it will be 7 years once it's published. But, you know, I spent many years before that actually just reading articles and watching television and, you know, consuming whatever media I could in order to understand that. So I can't even put a number on it because I think it was just something that was ongoing in my head for a long time of like, what else can I read? What else can I read before I felt comfortable really starting this project?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about something like the Olympics, you know, they compete in the Olympics, but everything that came before, right? It's all the lessons and the yeah. practice and the stretching and the everything else gets you to that point. So totally. In terms of your journey to publication with such an impressive bio, I am not imagining, Carissa, that you had to query or cold query or send your query letter out to random agents. I imagine you had people sort of knocking down the door going, when will this novel be finished? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, so I was really lucky. Like I said, I took a very long time to write this book. And in the meantime, I was publishing essays. Like I was doing a lot of personal essays. I was publishing some short stories as well. And, you know, I did have agents cold email me and say, hey, do you have a project? And I saw your essay in so-and-so place. You have a project in the works. And I was always like, yes, I'm working on something, but it's not even close to being ready. Can I reach out to you when I'm done? And I had like a folder in my Gmail account that was just like agents who have reached out to me. And I just, you know, kept throwing those emails in there. And when it was time, I sent an email out to all those agents saying like, I'm finally done. Are you still interested? You know, some of them had moved on already, you know, I think agenting is notoriously hard business. So, you know, some agents had already moved on, but, you know, there were quite a few others said, yes, please. I also did make a list of, you know, a couple of other agents that were sort of on my wish list that I also reached out to. But it's really, I think it's not ironic. I guess it's like fate, you know, it's meant to be, which is that the first agent that ever reached out to me, Michelle Brower, ended up being my agent, the agent that I went with. So it all came full circle. You know, she was the first one to believe in me and it just felt right to go with her.
I love it. Kismet. Yeah. And then, I mean, it's Putnam's lead title for early next year. So I imagine they weren't the only people to offer on the book. Was there a bidding war? Were there other people interested? How did that look?
Yeah, so actually I was very lucky in that Putnam offered a preempt. And so I, you know, didn't have any conversations with the other editors, but I had a great conversation with my editor, Tara St. Carlson, and it just felt right. And so, you know, we just pulled the trigger on that.
Amazing. Our listeners love hearing the journeys to publication because they love imagining it for themselves.
Totally.
And for our listeners, again, this is why doing those essays, doing those short stories is not a waste of time. Because you never know where they're going to lead to, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for me, I knew that I was kind of a slow writer in terms of writing a book length thing. But, you know, essays and short stories, I can kind of crank out much more quickly, you know, in a couple of weeks. And it felt interesting to me, too, to be able to have something to work on in between working on this long project. You know, the novel kind of feels like a marathon. You know, you're just kind of chugging away at it. It feels like it's never going to be done. But, you know, you get that little burst of serotonin when you're like, okay, I finished, you know, this one piece and I can kind of start sending that out and seeing if it wants to be, if anyone wants to place it somewhere. So I totally agree that like working on these short pieces and continuing to sort of send those out and kind of getting your publishing chops underneath you this way is like a great way, not just for you as a writer, like in terms of practice, but also like you said, like it, you know, if you get something that piques the interests of an agent or a publisher, like, you know, it's there under your belt so that when you are ready with a big project, you can point to these things like, hey, I do write and, you know, I have all that experience. So,
yeah. And it's okay sometimes to say to your manuscript, we need to see other people for a little while, right? Because sometimes it can be overwhelming. It can get too much and you're just too mired in it. And sometimes it's like, okay, we need to see other people for a few weeks and then we'll come back to each other a little bit later on. And sometimes that's the best thing you can do. Right. So I want to discuss your note on languages that begins the novel, because and again, for our listeners, I had to begin the episode by, before we started taping, I thought I was pronouncing the character's name correctly because I'd asked a friend in Hong Kong how to pronounce it, and he told me this particular pronunciation, and then Carissa had to correct me. And again, it reinforced for me how important this note on languages was. So can you just tell our listeners about it, about your thinking behind it, and why that was so important to you?
I know you've been following along with my vacation updates, and as you know, we're off to France this summer. Between the French Riviera and Paris, I am going to need some French language training so I do not embarrass myself abroad, and I will be working on my French with Rosetta Stone all winter to get ready. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. My husband and I are both going to focus on Rosetta Stone together as a New Year's resolution, so we're ready for vacation and to set a good example for the kids culturally, because learning a language of where you're traveling to is a sign of respect. We can't always assume that people speak English. We love Rosetta Stone. It is a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. There's fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really get to speak, listen, and think in your new language. It's an intuitive process designed to pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. There is speech recognition. They have a true accent feature, which gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It is convenient. There is flexible learning on an app or desktop or laptop on your schedule. There's amazing value, a lifetime membership of 25 languages for any and all trips and language needs in your life. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off, a steal. Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. Today, the Shit About Writing listeners can take advantage of this Rosetta Stone lifetime membership offer for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Get a book deal is on many 2025 New Year's resolution lists for our listeners. But working in the creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. And what is a book deal but a financial offer for your creative output? We should all love talking about money. As a literary agent, I love talking about money and how its growth can improve people's lives. And that's why debunking money conversations are important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creatives who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That is why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. You've heard me talk about Acorns before. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you invest with the spare money you've got right now. You can start with $5 or even just your spare change. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me, but I am very proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns, and I love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app and start saving and investing for your future today. This is a paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorn Advisors LLC is an SEC registered advisement investor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I knew sort of as I was writing the book that I wanted to be able to navigate honestly, the way that especially I think a Chinese person would experience moving from place to place with their names, because you know, if people are not familiar with sort of Sinitic languages, we, you know, have all the same characters, or many, mostly the same characters that can be read and, you know, mutually understandable across, you know, whatever region in China and Taiwan and other sort of Sinitic speaking places are, but the languages sound very different and are not actually mutually intelligible. So like, I can't understand Cantonese at all. I grew up speaking Mandarin, but I don't understand Cantonese. I live in Taiwan now and I don't understand any Taiwanese either. But, you know, if you write out the characters, you can see the same. So, you know, for these particular characters, the characters in the book, not the characters of the words, the characters in the book, you know, they grow up in Shanghai and they grow up with Shanghainese, which is pronounced one way. Their names are written one way that can be read by Mandarin speakers, that can be read by Cantonese speakers, but they would be pronounced completely different. So as they're moving through different regions of the world, their names are going to be pronounced differently. And then imagine them moving to the US and now you have a completely different name, possibly, which I think is very common in the immigrant experience. So I knew that that was going to be something that I wanted to represent faithfully, because I think that is a really big part of being an immigrant, being somebody who has to find a new home. And your name is such a essential part of yourself that, you know, I wanted to be able to capture sort of that disorientation that comes with having to respond to a new name, you know, and that's, you know, such a big signifier of yourself. And yet you have to get used to that one thing. Now, if that one thing is disorienting, imagine everything else that comes with it. So, but I knew also that it would, might be confusing to readers. So I wanted to include a little note to, I guess, point out that I recognize that it might be a little bit challenging, but to also encourage readers to go with the challenge, because this is very much part of the experience of being an immigrant. And, you know, just be able to, I knew that there would possibly also be Chinese speakers or people who are very familiar with Chinese, and to, like, you know, go into a little bit of detail about like why I chose to use certain spellings versus other ones, because there's a lot of debate if you understand these things about, like, you know, which spelling, which romanization method to use. But all of that was kind of just to set the tone, because I knew that it would be a little bit challenging and I wanted people to be prepared and understand my mindset behind that.
Yeah. I mean, so just for example, there are instances where Su Qi's name, in when we come back in time or we move to a different time, is spelled differently depending on what's happening in the world at that time. And so readers will sit and go, I'm a bit confused. I thought her name was this. But I loved what Carissa wrote. I'm just going to read it to you. It was at the end of that note. So it said, if you, the reader, find yourself confused, I hope instead of giving up, you might take a moment to imagine what it must be like for those who have to navigate this on a daily basis and then forge forward. And I really loved that because it made me question, is it our job as writers to make the reading experience as easy for readers as possible, or is it our job to kind of challenge them to rise to the occasion and do some heavy lifting? Like, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a fine line, right? Because you don't want to make it so challenging that it's completely opaque and, you know, readers don't want to try at all. But I think we can give readers more credit. You know, I think that readers are smarter than sometimes we might, you know, worry about. You know, we might worry that, like, okay, they're not going to get it, so I better make this completely, you know, transparent, and I may make it really easy. But I think that, you know, readers are actually really smart and, you know, enjoy having to be challenged a little bit. And I also think that, you know, at least for me as a reader, you know, when I'm reading, I am looking for an experience that lets me sort of live in somebody else's shoes for a little bit. And I think for me to let's say, like, not even like define every single word that comes in here, you know, every single foreign word that appears in the book. You know, that to me is part of the challenge of being like, okay, I am a reader who is on the outside, and these are characters who are on the outside. So I'm having the same experience that they're having, and I can get a little bit of taste of what it must be like. You know, I have the safety of my home. I can step out of it at any point in time, but at least while I'm in this world, I can sort of experience the story orientation along with them. So I don't think that my job as a writer is to make everything as easy as possible. I think my job as a writer is to convey an experience as authentically as possible. And part of that for me is the names. It's very much the language. It's very much, you know, allowing these characters to exist on their own terms. And that means that, like, they're not, you know, they're living in this world where they're not catering to some imagined audience. They're just living their lives.
Yeah, all excellent points. I just know that when it comes to publishing, you get your copy edits back. The copy editor was like, wouldn't it be easy if you did this and that? So is it that you and Tara had an understanding when she began editing this book that this was your vision for it, and therefore they weren't trying to sort of encourage you to make it easier? Or was it a case of they did try that and you just had to push back against that?
I was very lucky. I didn't even have this conversation with Tara that I can recall. I think she instinctively understood that, like, you know, this is the way that I wanted it to be. We didn't really have this conversation. There might have been one or two words in there that were much more unfamiliar, or like the context wasn't clear enough, in which I think, you know, I did make some changes, but then it wasn't like, oh, let me explain this term, but more like, let me just try to put this in context a little bit better. But I think that, you know, she probably instinctively just understood that this is what I was trying to do. And, you know, even in copy edits, the copy editor didn't try to make any changes either. So I'm very lucky to have had a team that just sort of got that this is what I was trying to do, and they went with it.
Yeah, it's so important for you to share that vision. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I feel like it can feel like you're butting heads and there's a lot of backwards and forwards, right? So I want to discuss, you begin with an overture, April 1947, Shanghai, and it's like this omniscient POV. It's almost like a very long establishing shot. We start with one character and we follow them through as the day begins and through this kind of neighborhood as you really set it up for the reader. Immerse us in seeing what this place looks like, what it sounds like, what it feels like, to really make the place come alive. Was that always your starting point? That's how the novel was originally begun? Or was it something you added later as, you know, we talk on the podcast of prologues. I mean, it could essentially be a prologue that's called an overture because of the music, but I'm interested to see what came first.
Yeah, no, this was something that I added in towards the end before I sent it out to agents. I had always had sort of a prologue, but the prologue was a different prologue. It actually originally was sort of their, you know, I'm not giving any spoilers because this is sort of in the flat, but, you know, it was originally their parting scene first, and much more. So, you know, I think this prologue sort of still takes place on the same day, but it sort of ends earlier. Whereas I think the original I had their fight in and all that stuff. And it just wasn't working. I think there's something about it that just, it felt not important enough to be a prologue, you know? And there's often like cautioning of like, you know, prologues, are they even necessary? If you have a prologue, maybe you should just cut out the whole thing. And so I was kind of examining it, and I was like, I don't know if this prologue earns its place, you know, as it's written, why is it even here? But there was something I wanted to establish, sort of the place and these characters and their relationship, like, early on, because we spend so much of the book with them apart. And so I was like, I think it's really important to have it start off where we at least get a sense of what their relationship is like. And it was only like, you know, towards right before I sent it out to agents, I was talking to a friend who had read a version of this. And I was like, I don't know, there's something off. And I had always had a version of this, but written somewhere more in the middle or something like that. And I was like, I think maybe this belongs at the beginning. Like, maybe what I need to be doing is establishing everything first. And I do love, you know, I do think about my writing in a very cinematic way. And so I was like, oh, like this is like that, you know, yeah, like the flying overhead and you see all the house roofs and stuff like that. I was so, you know, like I said, this book took me a very long time to write, and this was probably only added in a couple of years ago. Towards the very end. Yeah.
Yeah. It was so effective as that establishing shot. You zoom in, you zoom out. It was very cinematic, extremely, extremely cinematic, and really, really set the tone. I've got so many more questions for you, Carissa, but we are running out of time. And the one thing I wanted to discuss, and I wanted you to read it for our listeners, is how something like music can be used to frame a narrative and how it can also be used to move the plot along in some instances. Now, you've got, I think it's pages 86 to 89. Could you possibly read those for our listeners so that they can see exactly what I mean there?
Sure. He'd imagined this very piece, Brahms's lovely second movement, through 2 years of marching with his unit through the desolate countryside of northern China, hiking through dusty mountains and wading through icy rivers he could no longer name. His lifelong habit of muting the world so he could focus on the melodies in his head had been handy through nights of cold, hunger, boredom, fear. From that first battle, at the moment when his commanders had shouted, "Sa!" the word almost lost amidst the chaos of machine gun fire already rhythmically punching the air, he had instinctively shut everything out. Moving forward with his rifle, he tried to listen only to the single lonely violin that closed out the end of the movement. He would not stop to think about his friends falling around him, would not see the humanity oozing from them, soft and raw. He would not hear the percussion of explosions happening somewhere near or far, nor heed the popping bullets landing with a metallic ping or airy thud or gooey thwack. He would go forth in this horde of men, kill if he must kill, but if he were to die, it would be with Brahms's strings reverberating in his mind. In later months, it was Bach, his double violin concerto in D minor, or Mendelssohn, his violin concerto in E minor, sometimes Mozart, or Sibelius, Bruch. Music he no longer was certain he remembered how to perform in its entirety, but could hear in his mind as clear as the recordings of his old violin teacher, Mr. Portnoy, used to play on a prize victrola. Mr. Portnoy once told him music was a composer's conversation with God, that in playing or singing, anyone, priest or pauper, Christian or Jewish, old man or young woman, would have an audience with the heavens. Aside from the occasional temple visits his parents had forced upon him as a boy, Howard had never been religious, but he felt an element of truth to this, for he did experience something otherworldly vibrate in him when he played particularly well. So when, in 1949, he found himself finally back in Shanghai, or rather, on its banks, hurriedly boarding a crowded military ship to flee the encroaching communists, he turned once again to music. As a bomb sent a spray of water not 24 feet from where he and his fellow soldiers ducked, he retreated into the meditative opening chords of the third movement of one of Beethoven's string quartets. He tried to catch a glimpse of his childhood home through the chaos, regretful there had been no opportunity to stop by the Shikumen and find his family and ensure their safety. No chance to hold Su Qi, but the music carried his prayers that he would live to see them again, that they would remain well until that day came. The music didn't stop after he stepped off the boat and into Keelung Harbor in Taiwan. It wouldn't stop until nearly a year and a half later. In that time, the military moved him around, from northern Taiwan to the sweltering Penghu Islands to Zhoushan Island, off the coast of Ningbo, and so close to home he considered stealing a boat or swimming across the strait. By mid-1950, when he found himself back in Taiwan, building military housing he didn't qualify for during the day and squatting in an elementary school at night, the music had begun leaking away, like a sieve had opened up in his brain. Notes, colors, and textures he had once known perfectly disappeared. He awoke in panic at night, trying to recall if a phrase rose to an F or an F sharp, if it had been a cello or a viola that had entered a measure. And then one day, he tried to conjure up Brahms and found the symphony had vanished. Not a single note of it remained in his memory. All he had left was the echo of the feelings it had once evoked, of hope and regret and faith that life held meaning. Years later, once he was able to afford a record player, he walked into a music store and found a recording of the Brahms Symphony. That night, after they had finished dinner and Lin Yi was cleaning up, he set the needle on the record. The opening swells ripped through him. The pain, the terror, the homesickness, they all flooded through his system. He remembered his friends who had fallen right next to him, the surprised faces of the men he had shot, the ache in his fingers after his unit had been commanded to retreat, his hands unable to loosen their grip on his gun. Yi Jing, 5 at the time, had sidled up to him with an anxious expression on her face. "What is it, Baba?" she had asked, her voice a whisper. "Why are you crying?" Over the next week, he returned to that record store every day to purchase all the pieces he had forgotten, playing them nightly with the same terror and captivity. Lin Yi said nothing, until on the 6th night, in bed, she turned to him and said, "You're scaring the girls, you know. They don't understand why their father sits for hours, listening to the same music repeatedly, weeping." He began to explain, but she shushed him. "I don't need to know what it is those pieces dredge up. I assume it's something you're working through. I just wanted you to know the girls are watching." The next night, he started to remove the new record from its sleeve, Mozart's violin concertos, but he stared at the partially torn plastic wrapper and put the record down. He went to the closet and found the battered brown case he had hidden behind his clothes. He plucked at the A string, the one he'd had to replace with an Erhu string. It sounded slightly off in timbre, but workable. He called the girls over. "I want to play you one of the earliest songs I ever learned, a folk song you both will recognize," he said, cradling the violin to his neck. Their faces were curious, expectant, shining. He lifted the bow and closed his eyes. His fingers, miraculously, remembered the first familiar notes of Jasmine.
Yeah, geez, I got goosebumps when I read it and goosebumps listening to you read it. And for our listeners, have a look at how masterfully Carissa did that. We go forward and backward in time. We are all over the place in terms of time, and yet what is threaded through constantly is the music. Was that always something when you started the book, Carissa, that the music was going to frame so much of the narrative, or was that something that came with time and with the reworking of the novel?
I always knew that he was going to be a violinist, or I should say that as I was writing, it just sort of appeared, you know. I'm sort of a pantser when it comes to writing. I just sort of see what happens on the page. And so, you know, suddenly he was a violinist as I was writing him, and I was like, oh, okay. And so once I knew that he was going to be a violinist, then it became obvious that, of course, then music would be how he saw much of the world and how he worked through much of what was happening to him, you know, as a violinist and as someone who carefully attuned to music and to sounds and to things like that. I was like, okay, this is how I need to have him move through the world and have him understand things. So that was always there. And that passage you just had me read was written quite early on.
As a pantser myself, this is exactly why I pantse, because when things come, you know, out of nowhere, you could have plotted and plotted and that would never have been there. And yet it informs so much of the novel. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine this novel without him being a violinist. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who plot very tightly, open yourself up to the occasional pantsing. Carissa, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. For our listeners, we are putting Homeseeking on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Buy it there and you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time, and get your hands on this book. It is just beautiful. Thank you, Carissa. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Would you like to stand a chance of winning a registration for our upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat so you can learn from incredible agents, editors, and authors while also having the chance of winning life-changing prizes? Head to theshitaboutwriting.com and go to the Deep Dive page. Scroll down past all the details of the amazing lineup to find an image that you can share on your socials along with the reasons why you would like to attend. Use the hashtag DeepDiveOrBust and tag the podcast. Each post gets you a ticket into the draw. The contest ends at midnight on the 23rd of January and the winner will be announced on the 24th. We hope it's going to be you.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the writer in your life? Are you the favorite writer in your life and you want to gift yourself something awesome? Then come take a look at the Ultimate Planner for Writers for 2025. It not only allows you to plan for your regular day-to-day with hourly time slots, it also allows you to brainstorm, research, plot, outline, do scene planning, and vision boarding all in one. And it's available as a physical planner or as an e-planner. Check out Bianca Murray and find the Planner for Writers tab for more information. Remember to order early to avoid the end of year rush.